I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If you've been forced to fight as a child soldier, to maim members of your own family, shouldn't you see a therapist? We'll hear about the difficulty in bringing mental health care to children in Sierra Leone. But first, the Supreme Court ruled today that the death penalty cannot be applied to child rapists. Only two people in the U.S., both in Louisiana, are on death row for the rape of a child. In a 5-4 decision, the justices ruled that Louisiana violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. In another decision today, the court gave a major victory to ExxonMobil, cutting the amount of punitive damages in the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill from $2.5 billion to $500 million. Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSBlog.com is here and now Supreme Court watcher as well. Lyle, let's start with the death penalty decision. In addition to Louisiana, five other states allow for execution in cases of child rape. Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court's swing vote, wrote the opinion banning executions for child rape. What was his main argument?
He essentially makes two arguments. One is what might be called the narrow argument, that is, that since only six states now have the death penalty for child rape, there is no national consensus that this is an appropriate punishment for that particular crime. The more sweeping part of the decision was a declaration that the death penalty is simply unconstitutional when the individual victim does not die in the crime. So that second part of the opinion is a good deal broader. And in announcing that part of the opinion, Justice Kennedy said very explicitly, given our standards of decency, we must reserve the ultimate punishment, that is, the death penalty, for the worst kinds of crimes.
Well, in 1977, the Supreme Court banned capital punishment for rape of adults, and it's been 44 years since anyone in the U.S. was put to death for a crime that did not involve a death. But Justice Samuel Alito, writing the dissent, said the harm that is caused to the victims of child rape and to society at large by the worst child rapists is grave. What else did the dissent say?
The dissent said that the Supreme Court itself had discouraged states from passing such laws because the opinion of the Supreme Court in 1977 in Coker against Georgia, which struck down the death penalty for raping an adult victim, was much too broad in its scope. So state legislatures might have been willing to, and in some have attempted to pass laws to apply the death penalty for child rape, but those have been struck down by state courts. Reading the Supreme Court's 1977 case more broadly than Justice Alito said he was intended to be.
After today's decision, Lyle, on child rape and capital punishment, what can you gather from the past year that the Supreme Court is saying about the death penalty?
Well, I think it is very clear that the death penalty is going to be allowed in fewer and fewer circumstances as long as the present majority sits on the court. You have five solid votes for continuing to cut back on the death penalty. A couple of years ago, you couldn't do it against somebody who was a minor at the time of the crime. They also said you can't impose the death penalty on a mentally retarded person. So little by little, the court has been, and I suspect will continue to chip away at the circumstances in which the death penalty would be allowed.
Well, Lyle, to the Exxon Valdez case, the court cut the $2.5 billion punitive damage that had been awarded to $500 million. This means that the 30,000 or so Alaskans, commercial fishermen, landowners, business and local governments, who stood to receive $75,000 apiece under the lower court judgment, are now going to receive about $15,000. What was the argument for cutting the award?
Well, the court said that the notion that you can impose these heavy damages, called punitive damages, in the context of a shipping accident like the oil spill, should be approached with caution, because what we are talking about here is a concept that was made up by judges, that is, by courts, and not by legislatures. So we should be very careful not to allow this kind of blunderbuss remedy, that is, punitive damages on top of compensation for actual harms done.
It seems like a move to curb jury awards.
The court for years, Robin, has been engaging in a sustained effort to reduce the size of punitive damage awards. This fits in with that process and within that movement. And the court said in this context, that is, for a shipping accident resulting in massive damage, the compensatory damages and the punitive damages must be the same in amount.
And we should just say that in the dissent, the justices said that it should be Congress who makes these kinds of decisions in law and not the Supreme Court?
That's right.
Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Robin.
And we'll check in with Lyle again tomorrow when the justices are expected to issue their final three opinions in this session, including that highly anticipated challenge to Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns. In all likelihood, Sierra Leone has not been on your radar. The West African nation is one of the poorest. The over decade-long civil war that ended in 2002 was brutal. Nearly a third of the country's population was displaced, tens of thousands were killed, and more than 15,000 children were forced to fight as soldiers. How does a generation of young people recover from the mental anguish of that violence in a country that traditionally doesn't have mental health services? 31-year-old Suzanne Song is a psychiatrist who just finished her residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. She also works with the Research Program for Children and Global Adversity at Harvard's School of Public Health. They've been trying to develop a mental health system for child soldiers in Sierra Leone, and we want to learn about that today, and some of what we hear may be disturbing. Dr. Song, as she joins us in the studio, you just returned from Sierra Leone. What are the lives of these former child soldiers like?
I want to expand the term to war-affected youth because they were not only child soldiers, but most everybody was affected by the war. So a lot of the adolescents are having difficulties with depression, with anxiety, with post-traumatic stress symptoms. And now with the breakdown in state structure, there's a lot of drug trafficking, and the drug abuse now is kind of rampant throughout.
So they're self-medicating.
That's right.
With illegal drugs. Well, I want to jump in to say that we spoke on this program recently about the Ugandan rebel leader, Joseph Kony. You're speaking of Sierra Leone. This is in Uganda. He kidnapped children and forced them to be child soldiers and often kept them in line by forcing cannibalism on them, forcing them to kill each other, kill the weakest in the group. You know, what were these kids? Let's start with the child soldiers. You know, what actually happened to them?
A lot of them, and they weren't only abducted into the rebel forces. Some of them had gone voluntarily because they thought they had no other choice. But many who were abducted were forced to go back into their villages and either maim or mutilate or amputate the limbs of family members, especially the gatherers, like the women of the family, so that they would not be allowed back into their family, so they would have nowhere else to go.
Wait, you're saying that they were forced to do this. I was thinking maybe there would be some sort of, you know, rite of passage that they had to complete, but you're saying it was to ensure that they would be outcasts.
Right. And so that they would not be able to go back to their family or that village because now there's a stigma against them from the village.
You know, someone say, well, why did they do it? Why did they do what they were told?
For the ones that were abducted, they were taken by this rebel force and told, we will either kill you or we'll kill your family, or they were given promises. So we'll make sure your family is safe, we'll give you a car, we'll give you a home, we'll give you education. And now that's a large problem with the people who are working with former child soldiers in rehabilitation. They don't trust adults anymore. They're saying, I was in school, an adult came, took me out of school, made me use a gun, and how can I trust any of you adults now? And in addition, they say, I want the promises that you told me I would have. I want a family. I want a house. I want a car. So there's a lot of mistrust, which is then expressed as either behaviorally violent or aggressive or depression, anxiety.
When you say depression, anxiety, you know, they've become such catchphrases.
Right.
What do you mean? How does that exhibit itself in a kid in Sierra Leone?
A lot of kids will express more irritability and behavioral outbursts, difficulties with interpersonal relationships.
And we spoke of the child soldiers, but then there are the other children who might have been the sibling that the child soldier came back to maim or the sibling that watched a family member be killed. You know, what are the issues for the other kids?
Right. So they're the actual perpetrators and then they're victims. And many of times kids were both perpetrators and victims. The UN had come in around 1998 or so to start these what are called DDR programs, disarmament, demobilization, and rehabilitation. They basically had child soldiers come to them and give over their gun. Then they would go into the next step, which is demobilization, where they're put into different groups. And then they were put into rehab for skills, vocational training, either education or agriculture. Some of them were successful, but many of them were not. A lot of these DDR programs had left behind a lot of the children who were affected by war, not as actual soldiers, but there were a lot of, especially girls, who were porters or sex slaves or cooks who were still traveling with and working for the army or the rebel force. Mm. So because of this, there was kind of a backlash. So people had realized, oh, we're missing a lot of what are called bush girls. And so the international relief community had shifted towards gender-based violence programs to try to help integrate these other people who were not actually soldiers. The girl soldiers, or bush girls, are experiencing a lot of difficulties right now. And, you know, a lot of people express anger at NGOs, non-governmental organizations, for giving these packages from the DDR programs to those who gave guns, but not to those who gave their wombs.
Wombs, because they were raped and they bore children to the rebels.
That's right.
Huh.
And that these girls only know abuse, and these bush wives are not accepted back into their families because of the stigma of rape.
We're getting so used to hearing from Darfur on Across that there are horror stories, but you heard horror stories. Is there one, I mean, you know, these are horrible, but it drives home what these kids are living with. Is there one you can share with us?
Yeah, I spoke to a woman who actually I was staying with who had told me about a woman who was pregnant, and there were two rebel fighters staying on both sides of her. They were joking about and wondering whether or not the baby she was carrying was a boy or a girl. One would say a boy, the other would guess a girl, and then they slit her throat and then took out her baby just to see if it was a boy or a girl. They didn't really care, and they just disposed of the body.
So this is the horrible disdain for human life that these kids are around. And as you said, they're suffering greatly, and you're trying to bring them mental health care. But what exists now in Sierra Leone? What platform do you start with there when it comes to mental health?
Their mental health system is very limited in that there is one psychiatrist for about 5 million people.
No, wait, one psychiatrist?
One psychiatrist for the country.
Is it the government psychiatrist? Is it known as the...
He does work for the government. His name is Dr. Naheem, and he's been the only psychiatrist for almost 20 years. Because Sierra Leone is so poor in current resources, they don't have many graduates from their medical school. And even if someone did want to go into psychiatry, there's not very good compensation. You have to go out of the country to be trained in psychiatry. And there's also the stigma of mental illness. So people view mental illness as being, you know, a psychotic person running naked through the streets, but they don't think about depression or the effects of war on their psyche. Mm.
If they do recognize the issue, how do they care for it? Obviously, they're not all going to be able to go to this one man. So how does the average person in Sierra Leone take care of mental problems? Where do they go?
Most people go to traditional healers, where they do things like rituals or body washings, or they go to the Evangelican Church. And they do prayers.
And you say this is one reason the evangelical church has grown, because people use prayer as mental health care. Well, coming up next, what happens now? We're going to have more with Dr. Suzanne Song. And later today, is China's military power keeping pace with its economy? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about Sierra Leone and the mental health issues facing thousands of children forced into violence by the country's civil war. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Song. She's a psychiatrist working with a group at the Harvard School of Public Health that's trying to set up a mental health care system. So, Dr. Song, how will you do that? What's the goal of your group?
The goal of the group is to increase services for war-affected youth. I'm the clinician for the group, and as such, I'm very much interested in culturally appropriate ways of treating kids there, using their own vernacular about what kind of symptoms do they have. So, for example, a couple of the kids have talked about terms called faux straight or toment.
Faux straight, torment.
Mm-hmm. Which are different expressions of depression and anxiety.
Oh, maybe that's frustrate and torment.
It could be similar,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. And so those are their words,
right,
for how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to set up a program that speaks to them in their own language. And that brings to mind, here you are coming in filled with goodwill, but you're an American. Is there resentment? I mean, some people might say the problem is we need food, we need homes, and we certainly don't need someone from America coming to tell us about our heads.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had that?
Very much so. When you go to Sierra Leone, there are a lot of abandoned buildings where NGOs used to be. And the community does have some distrust of international organizations who come in, and sometimes they spend 1 month or 6 months. A lot of localers think that most of the funding goes to the administrative costs of the NGO and not actually to the Sierra Leonean people.
So they think that these NGOs are just people who are siphoning off aid instead of delivering it, which isn't, more than likely isn't true, but that's their perception?
To some extent. And some people do say that they're doing good work, but then they're gone. So, for example, one person had told me right after the war, NGOs had come in, they had trained local people to be mental health counselors. So they had 1 day training in how to be a mental health counselor. Then they sent these people out into the villages and provinces where they would stir up trauma histories in these kids, but then not know what to do with it. So it'd kind of be like me doing 1 day training on cardiac surgery, opening up somebody, messing around in there, and then trying to shove it all back together.
Or walking away and just leaving it open.
Right.
So it sounds as if you're part of a movement to build something sustainable in Sierra Leone, but you've already said 1 day training doesn't work. The teaching hospitals aren't producing doctors, so how do you do that? How do you change the infrastructure?
The goals are, yes, one is sustainability. And with that, you need to have buy-in from the government. Also to try to foster local Sierra Leoneans to develop their resources and to support their ideas. We don't want to foster dependence on international relief organizations. And one of the general practitioners I had met had said, we Sierra Leoneans need to help ourselves. You can support us.
Well, let's pick up on some of those things. Has the government been helpful?
The government, I think, is very overwhelmed right now. Sierra Leone is the poorest country in the world. It has the highest infant mortality rates, and now HIV/AIDS is becoming a problem. So mental health right now is not a priority just because they have so many other problems.
And why should it be? In addition to, you know, making life better for these young children in particular, why should it jump the line?
Poor mental health can affect the labor force. It can affect, you know, economic infrastructure, quality of life, interpersonal relationships, and just the rebuilding of society in general.
So how do you start changing it?
What we're trying to do is we'll go back in hopefully around December or January. We are inviting people from the ministries of health, of the Sierra Leonean government, members of the WHO, as well as local community members like paramount chiefs of each village, traditional healers, to, one, disseminate information, to say, you know, we've done this longitudinal study of former child soldiers. These are our findings. These are what we see. And so it kind of brings everybody together to the same table, and then we can all kind of discuss what resources do you have, what do you need help with, and how can we start to build a mental health system here.
Do you mind my asking a personal question? First of all, I should disclose, you happen to be a neighbor of mine, and you were getting out of the cab one day the other day. I said, oh, how are you? Where you been? Oh, Sierra Leone, where I'm trying to set up mental health facilities. Got my attention right away. You've chosen to work in the area of mental health, but this is pretty tough stuff, the child soldier aspect. What's it like for you to see this?
You know, when I came home from Sierra Leone, the first thing I did out of the airport was come home, and I cried. Yeah. I came to my room, and I cried for a couple of hours. I cried for the developmental delay that was enforced on these kids. I cried for the adults who had violently lost their loved ones, for the general poverty of the country. But I think I also cried just in wonderment of the people of Sierra Leone. They are a very strong group of people. The resiliencies of these kids is just unbelievable. And, you know, the strong women of Sierra Leone who carry tons of weight on their heads as well as a baby on their back, and I feel like they very much carry a lot of the families and the extended support network of Sierra Leone.
You're obviously still touched now by this, yeah?
I am. You know, everybody knows somebody who's been affected by the war. I remember once I had a soda once sitting in a restaurant with somebody, a local diamond miner in Kono, who had talked about how his family, his father, mother, brothers and sisters were trying to flee from Kono, which is on the eastern part of the country, to Freetown on the western part, and his family was stopped by rebel forces and killed, the entire family killed, and he was the only one that survived. But his story is everywhere. And listening to that just makes your heart sink. Mm. And for me, it makes me want to learn more about it. And I think especially a lot of Westerners or international groups that go into Sierra Leone, the thought from Sierra Leoneans is that, oh, here's another Western person coming, and they think that they know everything, or they don't even ask us what our needs are. They just kind of come with their money and do what they want. And I'd like to not use that approach.
That's Dr. Suzanne Song. She's just finishing her residency at the Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, Massachusetts. She's about to go to Stanford to continue her studies in child psychiatry. She's also a member of the Research Program for Children and Global Adversity at the Harvard School of Public Health. Suzanne, thanks for coming to talk to us.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, NASA's Phoenix Mars lander is gearing up to perform its first test of soil scooped from the red planet. If it finds signs of life, is that a good or bad thing for Earthlings? Still ahead today, Josh Ritter, after the news, Here and Now. When that massive earthquake hit China last May, the Chinese government mobilized active and reserved armed forces from all parts of the country to help with the relief effort. And it was one of the few times that the world has had a close look at Chinese military forces at work. We're used to the idea of China as a rising economic power, but as a military power, it lacks the ability to send troops abroad quickly or to refuel jets in flight. The country has embarked on a long-term modernization project, but how's it going, and what are the goals? Dennis Blasco is a retired military intelligence and foreign area officer specializing in China, also author of The Chinese Army Today, Tradition and Transformation for the 21st Century. Dennis, you've been watching China's drive to modernize its military for a long time, and behind the drive is China's last war against Vietnam, which ended in an embarrassing failure for the Chinese military.
Yes, it was embarrassed in 1979, and that was one of the motivating factors for the modernization program that really kicked in the early 80s and the mid-80s. And a lot of the modernization, ironically, is making the military much smaller than it used to be. Hmm. And as it gets smaller, it also gets more technologically advanced. But the important part is the goal is strung out all the way toward to 2049. 100 years after the founding of the People's Republic. Now, that's a very long-term process.
But still, this has caused concern in the Bush administration. At one point, Donald Rumsfeld asking, since no nation threatens China, one must wonder why. You know, why this growing investment in modernization? You say, though, that we may be asking the wrong questions and looking at the wrong things. You say that when we look at the military force in China, we look at what we care about in this country, and that misses about 80% of what's really going on in Chinese military power. What is that 80% that the U.S. is missing?
We often focus on the growth of their missile forces, cruise and ballistic missiles, advanced fighters, submarines, frigates, destroyers, things like that. Those are all very important. And in fact, their numbers and percentage of the force have increased in the past decade or so. But still, a large part of the PLA is equipped with weapons and equipment that go back long before this current state. So part of their doctrine is how to use all of this advanced equipment along with their older equipment. And in fact, they talk about themselves generally being the weaker side in any conflict in the future, and how the weaker side must overcome the superior equipped enemy.
Well, but they are also said to have the world's largest army. Where does China see itself as, you know, having to fortify? What is China anticipating?
The Chinese government has said officially that their active duty military strength is about 2.3 million people.
Oh.
Now, within that 2.3 million, there's an unknown number of what they call uniform civilians. Now, in the United States, we have about 1.3 million in our active force, but also supporting them are another 600,000 to 700,000 of these civilians. So if you look at just our civilians and our active duty force, we're getting pretty close to their 2.3 million size army. Now, what's also important to remember is that China has land borders with 14 countries. Now, four of them have nuclear weapons. And additionally, a lot of their reserve force and their militia force is focused solely on air defense and, importantly, repairing damaged infrastructure after the mainland would be hit by long-range standoff cruise missiles or bombs or air attacks.
Well, we've been talking about missiles and the nuclear aspect of China's military, you know, which brings to mind a perception many Americans have that that's the strength of China, that they have nuclear capability, that they may not even be bothering, you know, with other military buildup because, again, this is the perception of some Americans, that that's how China might defend itself. In looking at China's military strategies, do you get that sense that they have this ultimate weapon? Or is that just
sure.
is that just mythology?
No. In fact, nuclear deterrence is one thing that they do talk about. But just recently, the SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute for Peace and Research, stated that China has deployed only about 176 nuclear warheads. In the same study, they say that the United States has deployed about 4,000, over 4,000 at this time. So, in fact, the Chinese do have and acknowledge their nuclear deterrent, but much of their military modernization is focused on deterring Taiwan from taking further steps toward independence. And China really does not want to have to use military force because they understand that their worst-case scenario might be facing off with parts of the American military.
They do?
Oh, absolutely they do, sure.
Do Chinese officials say anything to you about this, or are you just reading tea leaves? And if so, you know, what do they say?
Well, first of all, neither the United States nor China has identified the other officially as the enemy. However, from a operational or tactical level, the Chinese understand that the capabilities of the United States are the gold standard. And basically what they're trying to do is to keep United States forces at arm's length away, force them to have to stay 600 to 1,000 miles away from the mainland.
As China becomes, well, more and more like the United States, an export country, doing business around the world, setting up companies in Brazil and, you know, oil and gas companies in the Sudan and Burma, selling their products everywhere, will they become more like the U.S. in that they're also going to have to defend their businesses around the world? We feel we haven't seen that kind of conflict coming out of business interests, but is it, you know, inevitable that we will?
Actually, right now, the Chinese are debating exactly those issues themselves. Can we do exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about? And from my vantage point here, 7,000 miles away, it appears to me that they have not yet come up with concrete answers to all of those questions.
That's Dennis Blasko. He's a former military intelligence and foreign area officer in the Army. He specializes in China and is author of The Chinese Army Today, Tradition and Transformation for the 21st Century. Dennis, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A quick heads up here on some of the stories you'll be hearing on Here and Now in the coming days. The city of Gloucester, Massachusetts has been in the news lately because of that spike in pregnancies at the high school. But as we'll hear, that Gloucester has a deep and rich history and a lot of modern day problems. And author Lee Mont will be here as well. That's in the days ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. We want want to wish Coloradans a happy annual Bike to Work Day. Organizers in Colorado say they're expecting a record turnout this year, and that's not surprising. With record high gas prices, more and more commuters are leaving their cars at home and pedaling to places of employment. Producer Eugene San met some new and veteran two-wheeled travelers in the Philadelphia area and sent us this story.
Greg Myers had been thinking about switching to bike commuting for a while. Then paying $62 for filling up his little Subaru pushed him over the edge.
You know, as I continued to watch the gasoline prices continue to escalate, I decided to do what I call exploit my own personal energy reserves. I could stand to lose a few pounds.
Myers, an insurance company data analyst, couldn't completely abandon his car. He lives 34 miles from work. So since Memorial Day, he's been driving halfway to this park-and-ride off the interstate and pedals the rest of the way to his suburban office park. It takes Myers twice as long to get to work now, but by cutting 34 miles a day off his driving and avoiding tolls, Myers says he's saving more than $180 a month, and hundreds more if you count wear and tear on the car.
Yeah, all set.
Ed Schuhart didn't need an incentive to take his bike to work. He's been riding for 20 years now, and he has the war stories to prove it.
I've hit cars. I've been hit by cars. Weather is always, especially in the winter, you never know what you're going to find. I've hit black ice on the way home in the middle of the night and found myself face-to-face with a frozen groundhog on Big Oak Road.
And Schuhart, an accounts manager for a security firm, does this commute without the benefit of any special facilities at the office.
There's no shower. There's no locker room, but I found I don't really need it because I take a shower before I get here in the morning. I get here, I just kind of relax, put my fan on, have a cup of coffee, then I get here early so there's no one around. Thank goodness.
Schuhart keeps his car parked at the office all week in case he needs to drive to meet a client. He doesn't bike to save gas money. He drives a hybrid. Over the years, he's mapped out dozens of routes covering the 10 miles between home and the office. Riding along with him, it's clear Schuhart has worked out a route with few traffic lights, so he rarely stops pedaling. Schuhart says planning is the biggest key to bike commuting success. Make your route safe and enjoyable, and keep a clean set of clothes at work so you look presentable at the big meeting. Schuhart says he can't tell if there are more bike commuters these days, but Mike McGettigan, owner of Trophy Bikes in Philadelphia, can. He says he's selling plenty of bikes to new commuters and adds that a spike in the sale of accessories that make bikes more functional is the real barometer of the effect of gas prices.
We're selling a lot more baskets. We're selling a lot more fenders. We're selling a lot more lights. We're selling a lot more helmets. We're selling leg bands to hold business clothes out of the chain.
McGettigan says many new bike commuters are weekend cyclists who see riding to work as a way to get more hours in on two wheels. Daniel Powell is not one of those. He bikes strictly as transportation. I met up with him on a bridge halfway between his home in West Philadelphia and his downtown office. We're surrounded by other cyclists. Powell used to take a trolley and train to work, but since January has found that a bike is faster.
Sometimes I can make it in 35, 40 minutes, but depending on the weather and the trains, you never know when you're going to get stuck in the tunnel. But on my bike, I can make it in, you know, if I really am aggressive, a 4.5 mile in about 15, 20 minutes.
Besides saving time, Powell says he's also saving money, about $50 a month, and is finding an unexpected benefit.
I'm not sitting in my chair and feeling lousy after riding SEPTA and stopping off at the Dunkin' Donuts buying my croissant sandwich. That's probably the best thing. It's now hitting the fruit cart as soon as I get into work.
And if saving money, losing weight, or freeing yourself from traffic jams isn't enough to lure you out of your car, Mike McGettigan of Trophy Bikes says bike commuting cuts your carbon footprint.
Everybody can use a little bit of extra self-righteousness, and if you jump on a bike and commute, you can go, I'm part of the solution.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
And our story on Pennsylvania's cycling commuters was produced by Eugene San, Queen, of course, supplying the music. Coming up, Josh Ritter, Here and Now. When folk singer-songwriter Josh Ritter was here back in 2002, he spoke of how Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Paul Simon had influenced him. You think?
If this was a cold war, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie.
You can still hear those early influences in Josh Ritter's new music, but some of them became mentors. As he told us 6 years ago, when he was a young optimist in Idaho, he sent his tapes to Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, and Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
As luck would have it, I sent it to some cool people that were really nice enough to write back.
Peter Yarrow not only wrote, he brought Josh to New York, helping to launch his career, which lately includes forays into the classical world. This weekend, he plays with the Boston Pops. Josh Ritter's new CD is The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter. He joins us from the Argo Network in New York. Josh, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Is this CD about your stunning conquest of the music industry?
Yes. No. Yeah. I was kind of just blown off steam, and I kind of wanted as like egotistical a title as I could possibly come up with. You know.
Well, you told us back in 2002 that at the time, I mean, by the way, you were 25 then, and you were talking about a few years earlier, you'd never been to a concert, and you thought that maybe there were just a few people playing this kind of music, so why not write Dylan and everybody else?
Yeah.
And shortly after Peter Yarrow, you know, calls you back, brings you to New York, you're suddenly on stage with Bob Dylan.
I think the lucky thing at that point was just not knowing that all that stuff is pretty much impossible.
Right.
You know, you do that stuff because you don't know the odds are against you. But really, like, you know, as I've gone on and I've started to realize it's just about doing it, you know, and having a long view of your career and what you're really trying to do.
Well, back in 2002, you were writing songs about, writing your name on the water tower back home in Idaho, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're writing about, what are you writing about? Let's listen to a little of To the Dogs or Whoever. This is cut one from The Historical Conquest of Josh Ritter. Let's listen.
Deep in the belly of a whale, I found her down with the deep blue jail around her, running her hands through the ribs of the dark, Florence and Calamity and Joan of Arc. I love the way she looks in her underwear. Those my page and the book and the plot.
Okay, so we hear references to Jonah, Joan of Arc, Casey Jones, Casey at the Bat, before finished, and someone in her underwear. What is this?
I've been thinking a lot about all the kind of people that have gone into making up, like, an idea of America, and I think that, you know, Joan of Arc is one that I threw in there just because, you know, I think she's something special. but what got me into it was the idea that, you know, as far as I know, Casey Jones and Casey at the Bat have never been in a song together, and yet they kind of die by hubris, you know, they die by this kind of pride that I think is really kind of, you know, reminds me of some politicians we all know well, you know, and I like that idea, you know. The curveball or the curve in the track were pretty similar.
Did you just make that
really
up?
I really don't know with my last record, Animal Years, it was a record about America and war. And, you know, for me, I was trying to figure things out without trying to preach. And so this record with Conquest, it was about, like, just kind of taking hands off the wheel and just trying to crack myself up and then recording it before I could think better.
Serenade me with rock slow.
I keep comparing back to 2002, but it's because we have this reference point. And at
sure,
the time,
yeah.
At the time, you said, you know, some of your writing would be in the car when you were driving in these long stretches between Wisconsin and Idaho. You know, doing gigs and listening to the radio and hearing these odd aspects of Americana come through AM radio. And I'm wondering, do you fly now? And what difference does that life make now that you're, you know, doing pretty well in trying to mine that Americana?
Well, I do most of my writing now in security lines. I think that the most important thing, I think, is to try and stay as hungry as possible, you know, in what you do. I really pushed myself when I was having trouble paying any rent, you know, and eating ramen. And now that I'm paying rent but still eating ramen, I feel like it's important to really keep on doing that because that's really the joy of it, you know.
Let's listen to another cut. Let's listen to Still Beating, another sound from the CD.
You're not the fastest drawing town now. How many times you've been shut down now?
Seemed like everybody else could see the things you never did. If you could yourself, you'd probably never have made it through the things you did. And your heart's still beating.
You know, I'm wondering, Josh Ritter, something else that was said of you early on is that you sounded what Nick Drake would have sounded like if he'd lived a little longer. Nick Drake, of course, the wonderful English singer who died way too young at his own hand. You know, you have that pensive side as well. Tell us more about that.
When I was living in Boston, I lived in an apartment, I lived in various apartments, but they were always in between floors, and you can't crank the amp. You play quietly, sitting on your floor on top of the futon so the sound doesn't sink through to the floor below, where the children's writer is quietly getting drunk. So I think that's one of the reasons why I started writing quietly. It's kind of, I think about it like a lot of times you're trying to paint something on a really small canvas, But I also I think pensive as well as loud, you have to administer those things in doses, I always felt like the most powerful records for me spanned a dynamic range and not just emotion or subject matter, but also in sound,
Well, and now you can make as much noise as you want, and you do.
Make a racket.
Am I making all the right moves? Am I singing you the right blues? Is there a time when I could call?
Recently, you've done concerts with the classical violinist Hilary Hahn, and you're performing with the Boston Pops. What is your sense of that? I mean, that's a big sound behind you.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing, to have all those musicians, and what an amazing thing to have 40 or 50 musicians playing my music. My ego is just enormous, even thinking about it right now.
And you get to wear a penguin suit.
Absolutely, yes, yes. Top hats and canes.
Well, what should we go out on, Josh Ritter? I'm tempted to play another big sound, but then also maybe to go back to something like Next to the Last Romantic, which has the more Dylan-esque feel. What's your choice?
How about Wait for Love, You Know You Will? That'd be a good one.
Okay. That's singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. His latest CD is The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter. And Josh, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
What would you say is Idahoan about you?
I think there's a real culture of tall tales, and I also think that there's a cultivated optimism. Also, it helps to think about yourself as the underdog,
Right. But, Idaho, don't forget we're next to Utah.
Yeah. We're like Utah with more sun and more potatoes, complex carbohydrates.
Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Make me wait the way you do. Time, oh, she loves me all the time. And she don't make me wait the way you do.
For more information on Josh Ritter, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Some days, baby, we all have to.